Your quality management system is certified once a year. Your software gets tested on every commit. One of those two things is actually managing quality, and it is not the one with the certificate on the wall.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a rather uncomfortable truth when you frame it that way. But if we look objectively at the operational architecture of, you know, nearly every traditional organization functioning today, that is the exact reality we're dealing with. We've basically built an entire corporate infrastructure around the illusion of quality control.
Four things today. Why continuous certification beats periodic audits for actual quality outcomes, the contract procedure separation that makes your processes executor invariant, how multi-unit operations franchises, regional networks can share quality standards while letting each location adapt how they meet them. And a real example, a complete specialty coffee operation specified in 25 YAML files.
Yeah, the material we are diving into today, it really represents a fundamental ground-up reimagining of how a business is structured. I mean, we are looking at a permanent migration away from the era of static narrative documents and moving toward a world of executable, testable, dynamic reality.
Right. So let's start by, you know, dismantling the current state of affairs, because the sources are quite aggressive in their critique of traditional quality management.
Very aggressive, yeah.
Like, if you look at frameworks like ISO 9001, they have been the gold standard since, what, the late 1980s?
Roughly, yeah.
Late 80s. And the mandate has always been pretty straightforward, right? You document your processes, you train your people on those documents, and then you have an auditor verify that you are following the document.
Exactly. That's the loop.
And if you walk into literally any mid-sized to large enterprise right now, you will find the artifact of this philosophy. It's either a massive, dusty three-ring binder sitting on a manager's shelf, or more likely these days, a completely chaotic labyrinth of a SharePoint folder.
Oh, the SharePoint folders.
Yeah.
It's just endless.
Right. Just filled with hundreds of pages of standard operating procedures. SOPs for opening the store, SOPs for calibrating the machines, SOPs for handling complaints. It's everywhere.
It is. And we have to ask ourselves, you know, what actually happens in practice. The documents live in that SharePoint folder, perfectly formatted, perhaps even updated last quarter, if you're lucky.
Right.
But the actual processes, the genuine, localized, messy way the work gets done on a rainy Tuesday morning when the primary espresso machine is throwing the pressure error, the delivery truck is late, and a new hire is covering the shift.
Yeah.
Those processes do not live in the SharePoint folder.
No, definitely not.
They live entirely in the heads of the employees.
Yeah. I think anyone who has ever worked a service job or really any operational role recognizes that immediately. You have the official way you're supposed to do things for the auditor and the actual way you do things to survive the lunch rush.
Exactly. To survive.
And that gap-like, the distance between the idealized static Word document and the highly contextual reality of human execution, that is the actual quality gap. That's where inconsistencies breed, where customer experiences degrade, and where brands ultimately just fail.
And the traditional management reflex to discovering this gap, it's almost universally the same. And it's entirely counterproductive.
Oh, they just write more rules, right?
Exactly. When management realizes that the idealized process isn't being followed, their solution is always to write more documentation. They assume the failure occurred because the instructions just weren't granular enough.
Like they didn't explain it well enough.
Right. They think, you know, the barista pulled a bitter, over-extracted shot of espresso because the SOP didn't explicitly detail how to adjust the burr grinder when the ambient humidity rises above 60%.
Right, right.
So what do? They commission a committee, they draft a 6-page appendix on grinder calibration, they distribute a new PDF memo, and they require a signature from all staff confirming they read it.
Which, of course, no one actually reads, or if they do, they completely forget it the moment the store gets busy.
Exactly.
But the sources we are looking at today introduce a concept that fundamentally shifts the blame here. The failure of SOPs isn't a human discipline problem.
No, it's not.
It isn't a training failure. It isn't a lack of managerial rigor. It is, according to the research on organizational schema theory, an actual mathematical impossibility.
Yeah, this is one of the most critical insights from the material.
Yeah.
We are talking about the R5 specification impossibility theorem.
The R5 theorem.
Right. So when consulting firms or quality assurance managers try to give you an exhaustive list of best practices or a comprehensive manual, they operate under the assumption that if they just work hard enough, they can map out every potential scenario.
Yeah, if we just write enough pages.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But the R5 theorem proves that this assumption is geometrically false.
Right.
It's impossible.
Okay, let's break down the mechanics of that theorem for everyone listening, because the math here is, well, it's staggering. How does an organization's operational reality become mathematically impossible to document?
Well, it comes down to understanding the multidimensional space in which any business operates.
Mm.
The R5 theorem models an organization's operational space across 48 distinct dimensions.
48 dimensions.
Yeah. And to understand where that number comes from, we have to look at the intersection of brand perception and organizational structure.
Okay.
So there are 8 dimensions of brand perception. These include the functional dimension, does the product actually work?
Mm.
The experiential dimension, how does it feel? The semiotic dimension, what does it symbolize?
Right.
Then you have the narrative dimension, the relational dimension, the temporal, the spatial, and the financial. Every single action in a business impacts these 8 dimensions.
Okay, let me make sure I've got this. So if I go buy a cup of coffee, the functional dimension is like the caffeine waking me up.
Yep.
The experiential is the warmth of the mug and the taste of the coffee. The semiotic is the logo on the cup signaling to my coworkers that I buy premium coffee. And the spatial is, I guess, the lighting and music in the cafe.
Precisely. You nailed it. Now you take those 8 dimensions of perception and multiply them by the 6 structural levels of an organization's architecture, which we will detail extensively in a moment. But essentially, they range from the high-level strategy down to the raw material sourcing.
Right.
So 8 dimensions multiplied by 6 structural levels gives us a 48-dimensional specification space.
And this is where the math goes entirely off a cliff.
Oh, it really does. Yeah. Because when you map out the potential interactions within a 48-dimensional space, even at a very modest resolution of variables.
Here's what kind of variables.
Well, factoring in things like weather changes, staff turnover, machine degradation, supply chain fluctuations, customer volume, you know, everyday stuff.
Sure.
The number of distinguishable operational configurations balloons to roughly 10 to the 48th power.
Wait, 10 to the 48th?
Yeah.
Just to put that number into perspective for you listening, 10 to the 48th power is a 1 followed by 48 zeros.
It's massive.
I mean, the estimated number of grains of sand on Earth is roughly 10 to the 18th.
Right.
The number of stars in the observable universe is roughly 10 to the 24th. The number of atoms in the entire observable universe is estimated to be between 10 to the 78th and 10 to the 82nd.
Exactly.
So 10 to the 48th is a number so staggeringly, incomprehensibly massive that human cognition completely breaks down just trying to visualize it.
It does. And that massive number represents the actual operational reality of your business.
Wow.
So when a management team writes a 200-page SOP manual, they're essentially throwing a dart into a universe of 10 to the 48th possibilities, hitting one single microscopic point and pretending that this one documented scenario covers the entire territory of daily operations.
It makes the entire endeavor of traditional documentation look deeply arrogant, honestly.
Very much so. You are trying to capture the infinite variability of the physical world in a static, two-dimensional text file. It means trying to close the quality gap by writing more instructions is just a total trap. You are basically throwing paper into a black hole. It will never, ever be enough.
No, it won't. Which is why it forces the completely different architectural approach. If it is mathematically impossible to write instructions for every scenario, well, you have to stop trying to write instructions. You have to abandon the monolithic SOP entirely.
This brings to mind the analogy of medical diagnostics from the deep dive. The traditional ISO 9001 audit model is exactly like getting a physical checkup from your doctor once a year.
Yeah, that's a great way to look at it.
You go in, they run some tests, they check your vitals, and they give you a certificate, a clean bill of health. You take that certificate, hang it on your wall, and for the next 364 days, you operate under the assumption that you are perfectly healthy simply because you were healthy on that one specific Tuesday in March when the doctor looked at you.
Right, but biological reality doesn't care about the certificate.
Exactly. Your blood sugar could spike, your cholesterol could plummet, your heart rate could become totally erratic. Meanwhile, a continuous glucose monitor or a smartwatch measuring your ECG, it doesn't give you a once-a-year certificate. It tests your biological reality in real time every single minute of every single day.
Yes.
And that is the fundamental difference between an annual compliance audit and what the sources are calling continuous certification.
That analogy captures the paradigm shift perfectly. The annual audit is basically theater. It is a calendar date checkup that only verifies whether your documentation was formatted correctly on the day the auditor arrived.
Right.
It does not verify the quality of the product being handed to the customer 6 months later. Continuous certification borrows heavily from the foundational practices of modern software engineering, specifically CI/CD continuous integration and continuous deployment.
Let's translate that for those who might not be software engineers. What does a CI/CD pipeline actually do?
Sure. So in software development, you have a team of developers writing code. In the old days, they would write code for 6 months, bundle it all together, and just pray it worked when they released it.
Spoiler.
Yeah.
It rarely did.
But CI/CD changed that entirely. Today, every single time a developer makes a change to the code base, even a tiny change, which is called a committed, an automated suite of tests runs instantly in the background.
Okay.
It checks for bugs. It checks for security flaws. It verifies that the new code hasn't broken any existing features. If the tests pass, the code is integrated and deployed.
And if they fail?
If the tests fail, the deployment is blocked, and the developer is immediately alerted to fix the error. The software is continuously certified against an objective standard of quality every time reality changes.
I should be testing my business like I test my software.
That is the ultimate conclusion of the R5 theorem. If you cannot exhaustively document the how for 10 to the 48 scenarios, your only logical alternative is to continuously test the what. You have to build an automated testing suite for your physical operations.
Okay, I am entirely on board with the theory here. The logic is bulletproof.
Yeah.
But I need to ground this in physical reality for a second.
Sure.
Software is entirely digital, right? You can run an automated script to check a line of code. But how on earth does a business write an automated test for a physical action? Like, how do you write a test for a barista steaming milk, or a housekeeper cleaning a hotel room, or a line cook grilling a burger?
That is the crucial hurdle, absolutely.
Yeah.
And it is exactly what organizational schema theory, or OST, was designed to solve.
Okay.
OST provides the framework to translate physical operations into testable parameters. It does this through a six-level cascade structure.
Mm-hmm.
But the primary breakthrough, like the engine that makes this entire concept work, is something called the contract procedure separation.
The contract procedure separation. Let's dig deep into this, because the sources present this as the antidote to the 10 to the 48th impossibility problem.
Yeah, the premise is that you must ruthlessly sever the requirement of what must be achieved from the instructions of how to achieve it.
Right.
In traditional SOPs, these two things are violently smashed together into one document. An SOP will say, you know, to ensure a quality espresso, that's the what you must grind 18 grams of coffee, tamp with exactly 30 pounds of pressure, and pull the shot for 27 seconds. And that's the how.
They blend the goal with the steps.
Exactly. OST separates these entirely.
Okay, walk me through the six levels so we can see where that separation actually happens.
In OST, the structure is divided right down the middle. The top three levels, level 0 to level 2, are strictly defined as contracts.
Contracts.
Right. And a contract in this context is not a legal document. It is an engineering concept.
Hmm.
It is a non-negotiable quality standard. It is the objective acceptance test.
Okay.
It does not contain a single instruction on how to do the work. It only defines what the successful outcome of the work looks like.
So give me the breakdown of level 0, 1, and 2 for our coffee shop example.
Sure. So level 0 is the overarching strategy and customer promise. The contract here might dictate: the customer must experience a premium, comforting beverage that tastes balanced, sweet, and clean, served in an environment that feels welcoming.
Very high level.
Yes. Then level 1 defines the sensory signals and the outputs required to fulfill level 0, this contract might state. The espresso must exhibit a thick, hazelnut-colored crema, a temperature of 65 degrees Celsius upon serving, and no astringent flavor notes.
Got it. Getting more specific.
Exactly. Then level 2 defines the process contracts, the actual physics of the interaction required to generate level 1. The level 2 contract states, an espresso extraction must yield exactly 36 grams of liquid from an 18-gram dose, taking exactly 25 to 30 seconds, using water pressurized to 9 bars and 93 degrees Celsius.
Okay, so levels 0, 1, and 2 are pure telemetry. They are the boundary conditions of reality.
Yes.
They represent the objective test. So if a barista pulls a shot and it yields 36 grams in 28 seconds using 93-degree water, it passes the level 2 contract.
Correct.
And if it tastes sweet and has thick crema, it passes level 1.
Exactly. The contracts are absolute. Now we look at the bottom half of the structure, levels 3 through 5. These are strictly defined as procedures.
Okay. Another procedures.
This is the how. And unlike contracts, procedures are highly adaptable, locally owned, and deeply contextual.
Right.
So level three is the human or machine step-by-step workflow.
Yeah.
This is where you outline how the barista holds the portafilter or manages the line of cups.
Okay.
Level four specifies the inputs and tools. The specific model of the La Marzocco espresso machine or the Malcona grinder being used.
Right.
And then level five is the sourcing and environmental context. Which specific local roaster provided the beans, what the ambient humidity is today, and the mineral content of the local municipal water.
Okay, I want to paint a visual for you listening because the sources included a diagram that makes this separation incredibly stark. Imagine a large whiteboard divided into two columns.
This is a great diagram.
On the left column, you have the traditional operational model. Picture a massive monolithic block. It's a giant PDF file or a heavy binder. It bundles the high-level brand promises together with the rigid step-by-step instructions.
Right.
It tells the barista the coffee must be excellent, and in the next breath dictates exactly which hand to use to wipe the steam wand. It is certified annually, it is completely rigid, and if the grinder breaks and they have to use a backup, the entire document is suddenly invalid.
It is a fragile monolith.
Yeah.
It shatters the moment. Reality deviates from the specific scenario the author imagined.
Right. Now look at the right column. This is the OST architecture. Picture it dynamically. At the top of the board, floating securely, are the level zero through level two contracts.
The what?
The what. They are written in machine-readable code, they are strictly version-controlled, and they are shared universally across every single location of the company. Below them, connected but distinctly separate, are the level three through level five procedures. The how. These are not universal, they are local files. And in this visual diagram, picture a second location branching off as a fork. The new location shares the exact same rigid contracts at the top, the exact same 25 to 30 second extraction rule, but down below, the procedure files are different.
Yes.
You can see a software diff view, a split screen highlighting the differences, showing exactly six parameter overrides where this new location has adapted its level four tools and level five sourcing to its local environment.
That visual is the core of OST. It illustrates the concept of making your processes executor invariant.
Executor invariant.
Right. The contracts at the top, the non-negotiable tests, do not care who or what executes the process. They are invariant to the executor.
Interesting.
The executor could be a highly trained human barista adjusting the grind by feel. It could be a semi-automated machine running a programmed profile. It could be an AI-driven robotic arm.
Doesn't matter to the contract.
The level two contract doesn't care if a human or a robot did the work. As long as the espresso extracts in 25 to 30 seconds at 93 degrees, the test passes.
Okay, I have to pause you there and push back on this because I am anticipating the reaction from anyone who manages human beings.
No, I know what you're going to say.
If I tell my staff, I don't care how you do it, you are being rigidly tested against an unyielding machine-read metric, isn't that just a dystopian corporate rebrand of micromanagement?
It sounds like it initially.
Isn't this just Frederick Taylor's scientific management from the 1910s on digital steroids? You are basically reducing human craft to a math equation.
It is a very valid concern. But if you look closely at the mechanics, it is actually the exact opposite of Taylorism and micromanagement.
How so?
Taylorism, and by extension, the traditional SOP binder on the left side of your visual, is true micromanagement. An SOP treats the human being as a programmable robot. It dictates exactly where to stand, what sequence of buttons to press, and forbids any deviation.
Right.
It micromanages the how, assuming the worker has no judgment, no autonomy, and no intelligence.
Because the SOP author assumes the worker is incapable of adjusting to reality.
Precisely. But the contract procedure separation liberates the worker entirely. It restores their autonomy.
By letting them control the procedure.
Yes. By only specifying the extraction time, the yield, and the temperature in the contract, you are giving the barista total ownership over the procedure. Mm. If the humidity spikes and the beans swell, the barista is empowered to adjust the grind size.
Right.
If the lunch rush hits, they can alter their tamping workflow to move faster. They own the how. You are giving them the boundary conditions of success, but handing them the keys to the vehicle.
That makes sense.
As long as they pass the objective quality gate, the test, they are trusted to use their human expertise to adapt to that 10 to the 48th dimensional reality that the manual could never predict.
That reframes it completely. Instead of treating employees like defective robots who need step-by-step programming, you are treating them like independent contractors hired to fulfill a specific SLA, a service level agreement.
Exactly.
But that still leaves the question I brought up earlier. How does the digital YAML file actually test the physical cup of coffee? Like physically?
This is where modern hardware integration bridges the gap. A YAML file is a structured data text file. It defines the assertion, extraction time seconds, 25 to 30.
Okay.
To run that test, you need a test runner. In a modern specialty coffee shop, the espresso machines have built-in telemetry, or the baristas use smart Bluetooth-enabled scales under the cups.
Oh, okay.
When the barista pulls the dial-in shots in the morning, the smart scale measures the yield and the time, and it beams that data to the local server.
Right.
The barista tastes the shot and logs the flavor profile, sweet, balanced, no astringency, into a digital checklist on an iPad.
Right.
The local server packages this data and commits it to the CI/CD pipeline.
So the physical actions of the morning prep generate a data payload.
Exactly. And the pipeline instantly runs the universal level 2 YAML contracts against that specific data payload. If the scale reported 28 seconds and 36 grams, the pipeline returns a pass.
The location is continuously certified for that shift?
Yes. But if the scale reported 15 seconds, a massive under-extraction, the pipeline returns a fail. It would automatically flag the shift supervisor or even temporarily lock the point of sale system from selling espresso until a passing calibration shot is recorded.
Wow.
The digital contract enforces the physical reality.
That is profound. It completely eliminates the need for an auditor to physically visit the store to check if the espresso is good. You have continuous cryptographic proof of quality generated by the actual work.
Precisely.
Which naturally leads us to the third part of our map today, scaling. What does this executor invariant architecture mean for a business that wants to grow? Because the narrative of expansion is almost a cliche at this point.
Oh, it really is.
A founder opens a brilliant local coffee shop or a bakery or a boutique hotel. The lines are out the door. The reviews are stellar. It's a massive success. So, feeling confident, they open a second location across town or in the next city, and it is a disaster.
Every time.
The magic is completely gone. The vibe is sterile. The coffee tastes bitter. The staff seems disconnected.
Ah, the classic second location problem. It is the graveyard of small businesses. And this connects directly to how organizational schema theory revolutionizes multi-unit operations, like franchises, regional chains, or global networks.
Okay.
To understand why the second location fails, we have to look at what traditional franchising actually is. Historically, if you wanted to scale a hamburger joint like McDonald's, what you were actually selling to franchisees was operational knowledge bundled with restrictive manuals and a trademarked logo.
Right. A franchise fee is essentially a toll booth for knowledge access. You're paying millions of dollars upfront and surrendering a percentage of your gross revenue forever just to rent someone else's organizational template.
Correct. You buy the massive binder of SOPs, and you are contractually obligated to follow them to the letter, regardless of whether they make sense in your local market.
Even if it's failing.
Right. But OST introduces the concept of forkability to the physical business world. It takes a concept from open source software development and applies it to physical operations. With the contract procedure separation, you don't need to rent the template. You can simply clone the repository and fork the business.
Let's walk through the real-world example provided in the sources to make this concrete. Spectra Coffee. This isn't a theoretical model. Spectra Coffee is a complete, functioning, world-class specialty coffee operation that has had its entire operational architecture specified in exactly 25 YAML files.
Yes, 25 structured text files contain the entire genetic code of the business. For those unfamiliar, YAML stands for YAML Ain't Markup Language. It is a highly readable data serialization standard. It looks like clean, indented text. So, Spectra Coffee isn't described in a 200-page narrative Word document full of paragraphs and corporate jargon. It is defined by code. There is a customer experience.yaml file for level 0. There is an espresso extraction.yaml file for level 2. There is a bean sourcing.yaml file for level 5.
So applying this to the second location problem, Let's say the original Spectre Coffee is in Seattle, and they decide to open a fork, a second location in Berlin, specifically the Friedrichshain neighborhood.
Okay.
Because it is a fork in the software sense, the Berlin location inherits the exact same level zero to level two contracts from the main repository.
They pull the same rules.
Right. The customer experience goal, the welcoming vibe, the premium taste is mathematically identical. The quality gates for the espresso extraction, 25 to 30 seconds, 36 grams, are identical.
But the physical reality of Berlin is not the physical reality of Seattle.
Yeah.
And this is exactly where the traditional expansion model fails. The original Seattle location ran largely on unwritten tacit knowledge. It relied on the founder's intuition, the specific rhythm of the veteran baristas, the unique mineral composition of Seattle's tap water, the ambient humidity of the Pacific Northwest.
None of which is in the manual.
Exactly. When the second location opens in Berlin, the new staff usually only receives the written manual. They do not inherit the tacit coordination intelligence that actually made Seattle successful.
Right.
They follow the manual blindly, but because the underlying variables changed, the outcome degrades.
But with OST, the Friedrichshain location isn't forced to follow Seattle's procedures. They're required to meet Seattle's contracts. They can safely deviate where their local reality demands it.
That's the key.
In the Spectra example from the sources, the Berlin fork differs from the Seattle main branch by exactly 6 parameter overrides at the level 4 and level 5 procedure levels.
Let's look at those overrides.
Yeah.
Berlin has significantly different municipal water hardness than Seattle.
Yep.
If they follow the Seattle SOP for water filtration, their equipment would calcify and the coffee would taste flat.
Mm.
So Berlin writes a local override for a different reverse osmosis filtration procedure.
Makes sense.
They were in a different continent, so they use a different local bakery for their croissants, overriding the L5 sourcing file.
Right.
They might be utilizing a different model of espresso machine due to European voltage standards, requiring an L4 input override.
Yeah.
And their opening hours are adjusted to fit the specific late-night culture of the Friedrichshain neighborhood.
But the contracts hold firm. The local procedures adapt, but the universal quality gates remain absolute.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And because the entire business is version controlled like software, you unlock the analytical power of the Git diff.
The Git diff.
Yeah. In software engineering, when you compare two versions of a file, the diff highlights exactly what lines of code were added, changed, or deleted. Yeah. For a physical business expansion, this is a superpower. You never have to guess why the second location feels off or why their quality is dipping.
Let's play out a scenario. Say the regional manager notices that the espresso in Berlin is consistently tasting bitter and astringent, failing the level one sensory contract.
Okay.
Under a traditional model, the manager flies to Berlin, spends 3 days observing the staff, realizes they are using a different grinder calibration technique, and yells at them for not following the Seattle binder.
Which is inefficient, expensive, and demoralizing.
Yeah.
Under the OST model, the digital CI/CD pipeline spots the error before a customer even complains. The morning dial-in telemetry is pushed to the pipeline. The pipeline runs the test.
And it catches it.
It flags that the new local level 3 grinder calibration procedure, one of those local overrides, is resulting in an extraction time of 35 seconds, which is failing the universal level 2 extraction contract.
So it knows exactly where the problem is.
The system literally highlights the specific point of failure in the architecture. It tells the manager, your local bakery choice is fine, your water filtration is fine, but this specific local grinder override is breaking the core quality gate.
Your ISO processor should be executor invariant. Write what must be achieved. Let each location decide how.
That is the profound liberation of this framework. You are holding every location to the exact same uncompromising standard of quality, but allowing their local implementation to be tested for compliance continuously. You manage the interfaces, not the implementations.
And to your earlier point, this completely disrupts the economics of the traditional franchise model.
Oh, completely.
Because if the operational specification, the test suite, the contracts is freely available to fork, then you do not need to pay a multi-million dollar franchise fee just to learn how to operate a business.
You don't.
You pull down the contracts, you write your own local procedures tailored to your city, and your CI/CD pipeline ensures you are operating at world-class standards. You earn your brand reputation through mathematically verified execution rather than by purchasing the right to display a corporate logo.
Exactly. This shifts the entire paradigm of what a business actually is. We are treating business specification not as a legal compliance chore, but as core engineering infrastructure.
But here's the part of the deep dive that feels the most pressing. The sources make it very clear that we aren't just designing this architecture to make franchising cheaper or to make ISO quality audits less annoying.
No, we're not.
We are looking directly down the barrel of the years 2026 and 2027. We are entering the operational AI era.
This is the critical inflection point that makes organizational schema theory an urgent necessity rather than just an elegant academic framework. In the next 12 to 24 months, organizations are going to start onboarding AI operators into their daily workflows.
And we aren't just talking about chatbots.
No, I am not talking about simple conversational chatbots or glorified search engines. I am talking about autonomous AI agents that will execute complex physical and digital processes, coordinate global supply chains, negotiate with vendors, and actively manage quality control loops.
And the fundamental problem that companies are going to face is that you cannot onboard an AI operator by emailing it a 200-page PDF of your standard operating procedures.
You absolutely cannot. Natural language. The narrative way humans write manuals is inherently toxic to algorithmic precision.
Toxic? How so?
Human language is full of contradictions, ambiguities, implicit assumptions, and unstated context. Let me give you a very simple example.
Okay.
Imagine page 12 of a cafe's SOP says, keep the reserve cold brew cold at all times.
Sounds reasonable.
To a human shift supervisor, based on their experience, the context of the physical fridge, and common sense, they know cold probably means around 3 or 4 degrees Celsius.
Right.
But to an AI agent tasked with monitoring IoT temperature sensors, cold is a terrifyingly ambiguous string of text. Does it mean 0 degrees? Does it mean 10 degrees? Does it mean absolute zero?
The AI lacks the lived human context to interpret the vagueness of the word.
Precisely. Furthermore, narrative documents are rarely internally consistent. If an appendix written 3 years ago contradicts a procedural memo sent out last month regarding milk steaming temperatures, a human barista might recognize the discrepancy and ask their manager for clarification.
Sure.
An AI reading a PDF, especially a large language model prone to hallucination, might just hallucinate a mathematically impossible compromise between the two temperatures. Or it might fail entirely, throwing an unhandled exception.
But AI reads structured data natively.
Exactly. AI agents are fundamentally designed to parse, manipulate, and execute upon structured data formats like JSON or YAML.
Right.
When your entire business operation is specified in 25 clean, explicit YAML files, the AI doesn't have to guess what the word cold means.
It just looks at the code.
It looks at the inventorymanagement.yaml file, and the file explicitly states, holding temperature Celsius, 2 to 5. It has defined fields, explicit data types, and measurable numerical thresholds. There is no ambiguity. There is only executable logic.
The sources use a specific technical phrase for how the AI interacts with this data. They say that AI performs graph traversal over explicit edges. Break that down into plain English for me. What does that actually look like in practice?
Graph traversal means the AI can clearly see and navigate the exact mathematical cause and effect relationship between every single part of your business.
Okay.
If you ask a standard AI chatbot a question about a dense Word document, it essentially just searches for statistically relevant keywords and tries to summarize the surrounding text. It doesn't actually understand how the concepts link together.
Right.
But an OSD YAML specification is structured as a relational graph. The edges are the links between the different levels of the contracts and procedures. When you ask an AI a question about an OST repository, it physically traces those links up and down the cascade.
Let's run a simulation of that. Give me an example of an AI traversing the graph.
Okay, let's say your procurement team is considering switching to a new, cheaper milk supplier. You ask the AI agent, if we switch to supplier B for whole milk, what customer experience goals are impacted?
Nice.
In a traditional company, answering that question requires a 2-week cross-departmental study. The procurement team talks to the finance team, who talks to the operations team, who tests it with the culinary team. It is a slow political mess of coordination.
Because the knowledge of how milk impacts the customer is fragmented across 5 different human silos.
Exactly. But with YAML specifications, the AI simply traverses the graph. It starts at level 5, the sourcing requirement where the milk vendor is defined.
Okay.
It traces the explicit edge up to level 4, the input specifications, and notes that the new milk has a slightly lower fat content.
Tracing the impact.
It traces that edge up to the level 3 steaming procedure, calculating that the lower fat will require a longer aeration time by the barista.
Oh, wow.
It traces that edge up to the level 2 process contract for foam texture and temperature stability, recognizing that the altered steaming time might push the foam density dangerously close to the failure threshold.
It sees all of that instantly.
It links that up to the level 1 signal requirement for visible craft preparation. And finally, it traces all of that up to the level 0 customer experience contract, which mandates a premium, comforting beverage.
That is incredible. In a matter of milliseconds, the AI maps the exact causal chain from a minor supply chain vendor change at level 5 all the way up to a potential violation of the core brand promise at level 0.
Yes, it understands the holistic impact of local changes instantly.
Mm-hmm.
And this capability is leading to a massive competitive divergence that is happening in the market right now.
Because the AI can optimize so much faster.
Organizations that have done the hard work of specifying their processes and machine-readable contracts are going to be able to onboard advanced AI agents in a matter of days.
Days.
The AI plugs into the repository, reads the YAML files, instantly understands the entire interconnected structure and constraints of the business, and begins operating within the defined quality gates safely and immediately.
And what happens to the organizations that are still relying on unstructured narrative SOPs? The companies with the dusty binders and the chaotic SharePoint folders filled with conflicting Word documents.
They are going to hit a brick wall. They will spend months and tens of millions of dollars trying to clean up and prepare their chaotic documentation into viable AI training data.
They get them VMS.
They will have to hire armies of consultants to manually map out what their business actually does versus what the manuals say they do.
Yeah.
And they will inevitably discover far too late that feeding their unwritten contradictory tribal knowledge into an AI just causes the AI to make catastrophic operational mistakes much faster.
Right.
You cannot train an AI on ambiguity and expect precision. It is a recipe for operational chaos at scale.
Okay, let me ask the elephant in the room question then, because this implies a radical restructuring of human capital.
Yes, it does.
If an AI agent can instantly traverse the graph, absorb all this coordination overhead, and instantly trace how a milk supplier change affects the brand experience, what happens to the massive layer of middle managers who currently spend all their time in meetings just translating SOPs into daily tasks for the frontline workers?
Well, it represents a profound shift in how we value human labor within a corporate structure. If you look at what we currently call organization, the matrix reporting lines, the endless status meetings, the sprawling middle management layer, most of it is not actually producing value.
No.
It is merely coordination overhead. It is the necessary tax we pay for translating high-level strategic goals into actionable steps for boundedly rational human beings who operate in a localized reality.
Right.
When AI and machine-readable contracts absorb that coordination overhead, humans are fundamentally freed from being biological compliance checkers.
Biological compliance checkers. Wow, that is a brutally accurate description of so many middle management jobs.
It is the truth. Think about how much of a restaurant manager's day is spent just verifying that the frontline staff follow the manual. Did you check the fridge temperature? Did you log the weekly maintenance on the ice machine? Did you date label the prep containers?
Just ticking boxes all day.
In an OST framework, the CI/CD pipeline and the autonomous AI agents handle the verification of the what. The system continuously tests the reality, so the manager doesn't have to walk around with a clipboard playing policeman.
Leaving the humans to do what, exactly? If the AI is checking the contracts, what is my job?
Humans are finally freed to focus on the why. They are elevated to complex problem solving and systemic design.
Okay, give me an example of that.
If a quality gate is repeatedly failing, say, the pipeline flags that espresso extractions are consistently running fast every afternoon at 3 p.m., the AI will flag the anomaly instantly. But the human teams will step in to use their judgment, their empathy, and their physical presence to investigate and redesign the system.
Ah, because the AI can't see the sun.
Exactly. Perhaps the afternoon sun is hitting the grinder hopper, heating the beans, and changing the grind distribution. The humans diagnose the physical anomaly. They rewrite the local level 4 procedure to include a hopper shield. They commit the new YAML file. The pipeline verifies it solves the problem, and the system improves.
Right.
The specification handles the routine coordination. The humans handle the meta specification. They decide when a rule needs to change, when a new product line should be introduced, or when an entirely new organizational capability is needed. They transition from being cogs, constrained within the system, to becoming the architects of the system itself.
So the overarching message here is incredibly urgent for anyone running a business, whether it's a single coffee shop or a multinational logistics firm. You have to certify a commit, not a calendar date.
Yes.
You must get your operational reality out of people's heads, out of narrative Word documents, and into testable, machine-readable contracts. You have to digitize the physics of your business before the AI operators fully arrive.
Because the companies arriving at the AI era with undocumented tribal knowledge are going to find that faster tools just compound their ambiguity.
Right.
If your foundational processes are a mess, AI will just help you execute that mess at light speed. It will be chaos at scale. But the companies with specified, testable contracts will compound their efficiency. They will scale flawlessly, adapt instantly, and deploy AI operators with total safety.
We have covered an immense amount of ground today, unpacking concepts that really challenge the status quo of business management. To briefly wrap up, organizational schema theory fundamentally shifts operations from static, impossible documentation to dynamic, testable, and forkable specifications.
Exactly.
It proves mathematically through the 48 dimensions of the R5 theorem that exhaustive SOPs are a dead end. Instead, we must separate non-negotiable contracts from adaptable procedures, creating an executor invariant architecture that lets us fork physical businesses just like software repositories, ultimately priming our organizations to natively and safely onboard AI operators.
And for those listening who want to dive into the technical bedrock of this, to truly understand the math and the architecture, the research behind this framework is available as 20-plus research papers on Zenodo, and there is a working implementation you could explore at orgschema.com.
Episode EOST3 goes deeper on the quality management side, specifically how this maps to ISO 9000 Year 1 and what continuous certification means for compliance professionals.
It is absolutely essential listening if you are the one actually responsible for managing audits, defending your quality systems, or dealing with the daily friction of compliance inside a large organization.
And if you want to understand how AI absorbs coordination overhead at the organizational level, episode 7 covers the franchise design question directly.
Which really expands on the economics of why the traditional franchise model, with its reliance on selling static knowledge binders, is so vulnerable to this open specification, forkable approach.
I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over. We talked at the beginning about the broken X-ray machine, how we've been relying on annual health checkups for our businesses instead of continuous monitoring.
Right.
But think about what happens when your continuous monitor is plugged into the public internet. If your entire business operation can be mapped, tested, and version controlled like software code, what happens when you decide to open source your operational secrets to the public? Does giving away your blueprint destroy your competitive advantage, or does it make you the undisputed architect of your entire industry?